Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are wading into a topic that has just exploded across cultural commentary, leadership blogs, pretty much everywhere. The provocative idea of the feminization of everything. Now that's an incredibly charged phrase, but what we want to do is, you know, cut through the noise.
It is charged, and our mission today is really critical. We aren't here to argue about the label itself.
Right.
We're here to analyze the underlying question that our sources are raising. Is the shift we see across modern institutions fundamentally a gender problem?
Or is it something else?
Or is this phenomenon just a highly visible symptom of something deeper, a foundational erosion, maybe a loss of a moral and logical grounding?
To navigate this, we've pulled together some sources that offer both the, you know, the central idea and some really robust counter critiques.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the commentary from Helen Andrews, who really popularized the concept. Then there's the analytical critique from Katie McCoy from a detailed World Radio interview.
And the view from the ground, so to speak.
Exactly. The practical observations from Greg Garner on corporate leadership.
So this means we have to dive into gender dynamics, the real-world impacts of critical theory, and the sort of essential non-negotiable logic you need to run a stable workplace.
Ultimately, it's about this high-stakes cultural conflict, isn't it?
It really is. It's this tension between prioritizing objective logic on one side and subjective feelings on the other, especially when big decisions have to be made.
Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start with the source that gave this whole discussion its name, Helen Andrews. What is her central claim?
So Andrew's argument is really based on observation.
Yeah.
She posits that when women become the majority in an institution, and she's looking at places like education, some nonprofits, large parts of corporate middle management,
right,
those institutions tend to adopt traits that have been historically described, you know, for better or worse, as traditionally feminine.
Can you break down those specific traits? Because I think this is where it starts to click for a lot of people listening.
Certainly. She identifies three key shifts. First, there's a move from prioritizing objective logic toward prioritizing empathy.
Okay.
Second, the institutional value shifts from productive risk, the kind you need for real innovation, to a focus on total safety and comfort.
And the third.
And third, instead of using direct confrontation or just objective analysis to solve tough problems, the system pivots toward prioritizing absolute consensus.
And that observation really resonates because people are seeing this play out. I mean, you think of university campuses where emotional safety can sometimes override intellectual debate.
Exactly. Or HR departments that might prioritize employee comfort over, say, hard performance metrics.
But let me ask the critical question here, the one that comes from the critique. When Andrews calls these feminine traits, isn't she just, you know, stereotyping a lot of really effective female leaders who use both logic and empathy?
That is precisely the most important counterargument, and it's something McCoy really gets into. Andrews is analyzing the behavior of the institution, the ethos, not necessarily the competence of any individual leader.
So it's about the system, not the person.
Right. She's describing a system where the pendulum swings entirely away from those so-called masculine traits like objective competition or rigorous debate, and the whole institution suffers from that imbalance.
The loss of balance. That's the key.
The loss of balance. It's not about the presence of women.
Okay, that sets up Katie McCoy's critique perfectly. She agrees the behavior is changing, but she completely disagrees that it's because more women are in charge. So what's her diagnosis?
For McCoy, these traits, the intense focus on empathy, the obsession with safety, they're just symptoms. The underlying cause, she argues, is the pervasive infiltration of feminist critical theory.
Right. Critical theory applied to gender.
Exactly. That philosophy getting into institutional decision making.
We need to pause on that because that's a pretty dense concept. Mm-hmm. For anyone listening, what is feminist critical theory and how does that actually, you know, work inside an institution?
Well, if traditional institutions sort of assumed there was a shared objective reality.
A common ground.
A common ground, yes. Feminist critical theory operates under the assumption that all of society has to be analyzed exclusively through terms of power, conflict, and systemic oppression.
And when you put on those glasses, what do you see?
You basically eliminate the possibility of shared truth or genuine collaboration. You even lose the belief that people can be judged by some kind of universal standard.
So truth and justice become relative to whoever holds the power. And that, I imagine, just leads to chaos. McCoy uses that fantastic analogy, the jungle gym versus the seesaw.
Yes, it's a great one. She says society should work like a jungle gym. It's this complex structure. It lets people climb, explore, work together, but it needs a shared, solid foundation.
Like a set of rules everyone agrees on.
Exactly. Whether you call that natural law or universal truth or just some higher moral standard. But the critical theory model, that creates a seesaw.
Where it's just a constant battle.
It's a battle. Success is just competing dominance. Yeah. One side is up, the other is down, and the whole thing is defined by that constant antagonistic power struggle.
And she's very clear that the solution isn't to just, you know, swap genders back. It's to restore the foundation.
Absolutely. She reminds us that virtue isn't gendered. Courage, gentleness, justice, mercy, those are virtues for everyone, men and women.
The problem starts when one virtue, like empathy, gets elevated above all the others.
Precisely. When it's unmoored from things like objective logic and justice, that imbalance is what causes the institutional decay Andrews is observing.
This philosophical struggle leads us perfectly into the practical reality that Greg Garner describes in the corporate world. He kicks off by saying that many of his best managers have been women.
And that's a vital distinction.
It is. This isn't about competence.
Not at all. Garner isn't seeing a skill deficit. He's seeing a cultural override. His core observation is that workplace decisions are being driven more and more by subjective feelings over logic.
And prioritizing comfort over difficult truths.
Right.
But a business can't survive on feelings. I mean, you need clear standards of right and wrong, best practices, quality standards.
And the big one, root cause analysis. You can't feel your way through a financial audit or a supply chain failure. If you try, you just fail.
That's the disconnect, isn't it?
It is. I mean, yeah. Think about a practical example from his notes. A major manufacturing failure happens. Your engineering team has to figure out why.
Which means confronting hard facts, pointing out where a process was objectively wrong.
But if the company culture insists on prioritizing consensus and protecting the feelings of the team,
Yeah. Well,
that objective confrontation saying this was wrong becomes culturally impossible.
And that leads directly to the core problem Garner identifies, psychological dissonance.
Correct. Psychological dissonance. It happens when a cultural belief system like relativism that says there's no right and wrong violently collides with the objective functions you need for stability.
So you can preach that truth is relative all you want.
But if the chemical mix is wrong or the bridge collapses, objective reality wins every single time. The institution ends up having to insist on absolute truth to survive while culturally denying it exists. That tension just breaks everything.
Let's connect that corporate dissonance to the broader social picture. This brings us to identity and polarization.
If we follow McCoy's model, the loss of that shared foundation, the jungle gym base, it creates a vacuum. And that vacuum gets filled very quickly by identity politics.
Which takes the place of traditional structures like family or community.
It becomes the primary source of meaning. And you can see the painful polarization that comes from that.
Yeah, the sources highlight the data showing young women trending sharply left politically while young men trend sharply right.
They're moving away from the center because their identity is now rooted in that antagonistic seesaw model of conflict. Not a shared foundation of collaboration.
And this foundation crisis changes how institutions govern. Betsy DeVos warned about this, about compassion becoming unmoored from justice.
When that happens, institutions inevitably elevate feelings, the immediate subjective experience, over verifiable facts or long-term fairness. And that's the mechanism that creates the dissonance we were just talking about.
This whole debate really pivots on moral grounding. And Garner's final point touches on something really profound about our culture's philosophical core, the idea of guilt and transformation.
Yeah, this part is fascinating. The observation that our culture seems to have this deep, almost aggressive belief in permanent guilt.
But not redemption.
But has completely lost the capacity to believe in redemption or genuine, significant transformation.
Which means we lose the ability to reconcile. If there's no shared foundation of truth or moral law, where would redemption even come from?
Precisely. If truth is relative, then moral growth is also relative. There's no universal standard to measure transformation against.
So the culture just holds on to the transgression, the worst chapter of a person's life.
And denies the philosophical possibility that they could actually grow, because without a fixed point of truth, there's nothing to transform toward.
Garner uses a high-profile figure as an example to illustrate this. The point isn't about the person, but the dynamic, right? That without a belief in universal truth, transformation becomes functionally impossible for anyone.
Absolutely. The example is just there to show that our culture is becoming obsessed with defining identity by past failures rather than future potential. If there's no agreed-upon better self or objective moral standard, the judgment just stands forever.
And that prevents institutional progress, but also individual progress.
For sure.
This has been a really complex but necessary deep dive. To synthesize all this for our listener, where does the focus need to be to restore some stability?
I think the central takeaway is, well, it's pretty undeniable. Mm-hmm. The fundamental problem isn't really gender dynamics. It's the widespread lack of a shared agreed upon foundation.
Right.
Call it natural law, universal truth, or just a consistent higher standard that goes beyond how we feel in the moment. That foundation is what allows both logic and compassion to thrive without destroying the system.
So according to these sources, society needs to reclaim a blend of objective truth, informed compassion, rational logic, and clear moral grounding.
You need the competence and the caring, but both have to stand on a solid, knowable foundation, or you just get that institutional dissonance.
And that brings us to a final provocative thought for you to consider, and it ties right back to that idea of permanent guilt.
What are the practical, measurable costs in business, in our institutions, and maybe most importantly, in our own personal growth? When a culture stops believing in the possibility of genuine transformation and redemption.
And what foundations must you reclaim in your own thinking to avoid living and working in that state of self-inflicted psychological dissonance?